This is the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network.
Hello, and welcome to Bodies of Horror, the podcast where we look at all of our favorite horror films from classic, the camp, to the cringe, through the lens of disability. I am your host, Nicole, and I am thrilled to have you here. What is on the examination table for this episode? We are definitely going to be doing things a little bit differently, I think, for this episode. And I'm going to be talking about two films that are currently in theaters. Lots of folks have been talking about them. I've seen them and was really taken aback by just how these films struck me and kind of stayed with me after watching them. And so as I began to kind of set with them, I thought, well, maybe I should do an episode just kind of sharing my thoughts, my feelings on ways that these films touch on topics that we've already discussed, maybe going a little bit deeper, going into some new territory. So, what films are we talking about? Well, we are going to be chatting about The First Omen, directed by Arkasha Stevenson and starring Nell Tiger-Free, and Immaculate, starring Sydney Sweeney and directed by Michael Mohan. So, really excited to get into some religious horror. You know I love it. As well as get into some nunsploitation and really connect some ideas around bodily autonomy and disability, because I think obviously these films are looking at bodily autonomy in one very specific realm, but I think in both films there are some examples of how the conversation becomes a little bit broader, but I also want to connect the importance of why talking about these films, specifically through the way that they're having conversations about bodily autonomy, is also very important. It's going to get, I think, a little complex, so as always, I beg a little bit of grace and patience with y'all as I try to unpack, I think, some of these bits. Also, because these films are still currently in theaters, I do feel the need to kind of give a spoiler warning. So if you haven't seen these films and you are worried about being spoiled, I would push pause. Come back to this after you've seen them. I do think that these movies are worth seeing. So definitely check them out. But if you're worried about that, we are going to talk about lots of details. So, you know, you may just want to be aware of that. Chatting about these films is a little bit complex, too, because they are very similar. They have a lot of similar beats to them, to the point that maybe watching them, you get these moments of deja vu. But I will say, I don't think that this is necessarily a bad thing. I think the films, even though they are having some similar ideas at play, and certainly there are a number of scenes that do strike kind of certain similar cadences, I don't think it feels like a retread of anything. So I do want to say that. But instead of talking about these films, you know, going to our old friend Encyclopedia and doing plot synopsis for each film, we just want to really talk about both of them kind of together. So, good friend Wikipedia has the week off, and I'm going to kind of break down these films side by side. So, both films are really centered on a young baby nun joining a convent, taking their vows or taking the veil, and joining convent. In Immaculate, we follow Cecilia, played by Sydney Sweeney, while she is joining a convent in rural Italy. And it's a convent that serves as kind of like a hospice for nuns that are kind of end of life. So they have a number of younger nuns there that are, caring for some of the elders. And so she has kind of flown to Italy and is now joining this convent. In the First Omen, we have Margaret, who has grown up in the Catholic Church, ostensibly. She has been raised in a Catholic orphanage and has been invited to join a convent in Italy by one of, I think, the overseers of the orphanage that she grew up in. And so she arrives in Rome. So where Immaculate takes place in a rural setting, this is in Rome. And from the jump, we do get those differences because we are navigating the city with Margaret, and she's very kind of excited about, being in kind of the hustle and bustle of a city. There's protests. So, this takes place, just prior to the First Omen. So we are talking about the 70s, and we're having student protests. And this kind of underscores some of the ideas that are at play, and I'll touch a little bit more on them as we go along. But we have students protesting, and the father that is with her, taking her to the convent, just kind of mentions, the kind of social political tone of the time. Now, where Cecilia's convent is rural and serves as a hospice of sorts, the convent that Margaret is joining appears to be more in line with an orphanage. And so there's lots of kids around. Now, as similar as the films have been up until this point, kind of continues down this road. We get these moments of both Cecilia and Margaret in their respective films and establishing themselves within their new location, meeting other nuns, and we get introduced to other characters, kind of the structure of these convents. And then both women experience kind of a blackout of sorts. Margaret's is around her going out. One of the other nuns invites her out before they have taken their vows, or taken the veil, to have kind of, a night out at a club. And she's dancing with this man, she's drinking, and kind of a last hurrah, I suppose. And she blacks out and she doesn't really recall what happened the night before. And we don't really come back to that for quite a bit. Cecilia in Immaculate has a very similar kind of situation occur where the convent is having kind of a reception or a party to welcome these new nuns that are joining their convent. And she gets ill, she passes out, and with her, we quickly discover that she is pregnant. And so the films then slightly take on different tones here because we've established very early on that Cecilia is now pregnant and she's a nun. She's never had sex. She's never been in a situation where she's had sex. She joined the church at a very young age. We get a little bit of background on Cecilia where Margaret was an orphan that was raised in an orphanage connected with the Catholic Church. Cecilia turned to the church at a very young age after a near-death experience, I suppose, although it's explained that she did technically die. She was in an accident, she fell through some ice, was pronounced dead, but came back, and has felt since that young age that there has been something greater for her. She felt, that she had been touched by God in some way. And so she wanted to dedicate her life to that service and thus becoming a nun. So, but in Immaculate, it is confirmed that Cecilia is pregnant is considered a miracle, a blessing, almost like an immaculate conception. And we even have a moment, a bit of a ritual where Cecilia is dressed up and presented a la Mary. And it's a very striking image. It's the image that you see on a lot of posters, etc. But she begins to kind of put some things together. She's attacked by one of the fellow nuns who tries to drown her in a pool, screaming that it should have been her. And she becomes very ill. Cecilia becomes very ill. She's throwing up. She throws up one of her teeth. She asks for go to an actual hospital to be seen by a doctor because they're not taking her to, you know, go and get outside care. They're doing everything at the convent. So she is asking for care and being denied, saying they will do everything there, but her body is in some bad shape. Meanwhile, over at the First Omen, you know, we have Margaret. She's not presenting any signs of pregnancy, but again, we have those similar blackout moments. And we are starting to unravel a bit of mystery here at this convent all around this girl named Carlita. She's an orphan and is being isolated and poorly treated here. She's considered aggressive and a threat to others, but Margaret is trying to build a relationship and kind of form a bond with her. And so we then start to unpack this mystery. We realize that via Father Brennan, who is kind of the, you know, I'm here to kind of give you the warnings and guide you along this journey. He tells her, hey, this church is basically trying to birth the Antichrist, to bring people back to the church. We've seen a rise in secularism and all these things are going on, and we want people back to the church. So we think that the way to do this is to have the Antichrist, or this is what this church is saying. So then they discover that Carlita is, I guess, one of these children that have been born as part of this experiment, and is one of the only survivors. But in examining files, we learn that there is another survivor. It takes a minute to figure out who it is, but of course, it is, in fact, Margaret, who discovers that there is a 666 kind of birthmark on her scalp. She had seen Carlita's 666 birthmark on the roof of her mouth, on her palate. And the other children that have been part of this experiment, we see photos of them. These are deformed fetuses. We don't really get any context of them, if these were fetuses that were actually born, or if they were stillborn. We don't get any background of how these experiments have really shaken out in either film. So, yes, let's go back to Immaculate. So, again, we have Cecilia pregnant, and, you know, how that be? She's a virgin, and it's been a hot minute since there's been an Immaculate Conception. So, we begin to kind of put some pieces together here. When Cecilia first arrived at the convent, we learn that this convent houses an artifact, one of the nails from the cross Jesus was crucified on. And we, you know, this is an artifact held in very high regard. And it is discovered that They are trying to take a different track here than the first Omen. Instead of birthing the Antichrist, they're trying to spawn Christ via some DNA samples. We learned that kind of the head priest here at this convent has a background in genetics and biology, and so he's been doing these experimentations. And we see in kind of this chamber, jars of fetuses, and again, very similar in vein to what we just talked through with the first Omen, and seeing all of these fetuses and babies that have been born deformed. I don't know. I'll talk a little bit more about this in just a second. But so we then enter into kind of the end stages of both films. Now, Margaret has had no signs of pregnancy. She's just discovered that she is the product of this kind of birthing of the Antichrist experiment, alongside Carlita, both of them, for all intents and purposes, being the only survivors of this. And the idea here is that they are going to use Carlita to be a vessel for the next Antichrist. And this is really what Margaret is trying to do. She's trying to save Carlita. But when she discovers that she is in fact also part of these experiments, she realizes that it's probably her, that she is going to be the vessel, and surprise, she is pregnant. And she becomes very suddenly pregnant about that pop time. It's a very kind of possession inspired, if you've seen that film, a very possession inspired moment, where we get some good body horror of her basically becoming pregnant and ready to pop, ready to have this child. And so, yeah, both films end with women being forced to have these children. And Margaret has twins. She has a son and a daughter. So part of with the first Omen, while we're talking about it, to kind of put a bow on it. So the idea was that these experiments haven't worked because the beast, the father, if you will, of these of the Antichrist has to have sex or has to procreate with its own progeny. So it needs to have sex with one of its spawn. And so that's why she, Margaret thought that Carlita was going to be this person, but finds out it's her. So, but it has to be a male heir. And so she has twins. She has a female and a male. And she gives birth. It's very intense, and a really fascinating sequence. If I'm recalling this bit of info, just listen to the Horror Queers Patreon episodes on both of these and kind of prep for this record. And I want to say that this was a sequence that they struggled with the MPAA on because it's pretty out there. So she gives birth, and it's twins, a male and a girl. The male is picked up by the kind of the excited church folk that now have their Antichrist, and they leave Margaret and the female baby to die. And I think Carlita is now in the mix. I think she has shown up as well. And so they're going to just set everything aflame, and they're dead, and there's no I guess, sign of what has happened. Immaculate ends a little bit differently. So Cecilia tries to escape the convent after, I think, piecing all of these things together. She tries to escape by kind of faking a miscarriage of sorts. She kills, I think, a few chickens and uses the blood and what have you to kind of create a scene of a miscarriage so that people there at the church will be encouraged to take her to an actual hospital to get medical care. Well, this is found out en route to the hospital. And so she makes an escape. She gets to these catacombs and is chased by the head priest who has been doing these experimentations. And she ends up killing him. She kills, I think, kind of the nun, the right-hand nun, after they've captured Cecilia and have her contained. She breaks free, and after killing the nun, and head priest gets set on fire, killed kind of in his lab. She makes an escape through some of these, like, underground catacombs, gives birth, and surprise, priest isn't dead. He's chased her there. She does finally kill him off. Baby comes out and she goes rock-a-bye baby. Literally, she smashes the baby with the rock. The baby makes sounds. My understanding is that this sounds, and again, this is from the Horror Queers episode on it. I think it was the sound of a cat and a baby kind of mixed in an interesting way. It doesn't sound like a typical crying baby after birth. And I have some additional thoughts and feelings on that. But that's kind of a really tangled, messy plot description of both. So you can kind of see how both of these films are very similar. They go very much hand in hand. And, of course, these films are having conversation about bodily autonomy through a very specific lens of reproductive right. Both of these women are experiencing a forced pregnancy and a forced birth. These are women that are celibate, that have taken a vow of chastity. And now they are going through pregnancy and birth. And all sans their consent. The fact that these films are coming out in 2024, I think, is very, I think, pointed in making some commentary on where we are within reproductive health, especially within the United States. We've had Roe versus Wade overturned and just kind of the ongoing battle within that. The fact that these are also framed within a religious horror context, I think, is also very interesting, because when we think of the anti-choice movements and kind of these pro-forced birth, I think, things, we do usually see these spearheaded by those within kind of a religious community, be it Catholicism or other kind of evangelical Protestant Christianity, etc. And so it's all quite, I think, very, I think there's a lot to unpack within that. I'm not going to go all in on kind of the religious components of kind of abortion and how all of that comes into play. There's an episode of the Leaving Eden podcast. I'm a huge fan of the Leaving Eden podcast. And there's an episode that they did a while ago that really breaks down some of the religious connections as to why you do see Catholicism and these other more conservative sects of Christianity being spearheads within kind of the forced birth movement. And so I will provide a link there. I highly recommend taking a lesson, but it really does a nice job at cutting apart all of these different components and why we have different factions and kind of different tenors to it all. It, you know, when we talk about abortion and how folks talk about abortion, it becomes complicated because we're looking at different complex components. First and foremost is, where does life begin? When we think about religion, religion is really the framework that folks view kind of humanity, both, you know, what is the meaning of life and what is the value of our existence as a person. And so, you know, focusing in on that first bit, you know, it's, where does life begin? Does it begin at fertilization? Does it begin at conception? Does it begin at that first heartbeat? Does it begin at viability? So when that fetus, you would, you know, you're getting those increased chances of, you know, having birth and that child surviving. Is that kind of when life begins? Or does it begin when you've had the child, when the child is out of the womb? Or as many fundamentalists will say, when that child becomes Earthside. So there's that component. And this is why you have things like heartbeat laws and just back and forth. And why you have certain sects of Christianity that are very anti-contraceptives, especially hormonal contraceptives like IUDs, birth control pills, things like that. Because they believe that's infringing on, you know, whether you believe that life begins at conception or fertilization. Just lots of complexity here. So if that's something that you really want to dig in on, I definitely recommend giving that podcast a listen. The hosts have, I think, some pretty interesting perspective here, especially one of the hosts, Sadie, comes from a very conservative fundamentalist background and has done quite a bit of deconstruction. It's really what the crux of the podcast is about. And so this episode really digs into what, you know, these different beliefs and how they've kind of come about, how they're framed, and what folks are taught, and why certain beliefs are really instilled in I think, younger and younger folks. So it's an interesting episode, but I'm not going to go deep into that because I think that there's been lots of conversation around, I think, bodily autonomy through that specific component of reproductive health. I want to start unpacking these films and talking about bodily autonomy outside of just the reproductive health lens. And to do that, I do want to provide a little bit of connective tissue. In previous episodes, I've talked a little bit about reproductive health as it relates to disability, specifically for sterilizations, forced abortions, for folks that are disabled. A lot of this has been tied to specific elements of the eugenics movement. But it's still something that is ongoing today. And this is something that is really hard to explain to people when we start having broader conversations about bodily autonomy. There's this assumption that that's not an issue for folks with disabilities because we've never really gone to that place. So, for example, just to put this in a little bit more of a specific context, I wanted to look up some recent laws or pieces of legislation, things like that, that spoke to disability and reproductive rights. And so over at the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network website, which I will link in the show notes, they referenced the Doe X. Rel. Tarlow versus DC. And it was a court case decided in 2007. Three women with intellectual disabilities brought a lawsuit against the Washington, D.C. Developmental Disabilities Administration. The Developmental Disabilities Administration is the part of the Washington, D.C. government that works with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. The women said that the Developmental Disabilities Administration forced them to have surgery against their will. One woman said she was forced to have eye surgery. The other two women said they were forced to have abortions. The court case did not go to the Supreme Court, but one of the lower court judges who decided it is now a Supreme Court justice. That justice's name is Brett Kavanaugh. In this court case, Brett Kavanaugh said that the Developmental Disabilities Administration didn't have to ask the women what they thought about the surgeries. Brett Kavanaugh said that what the women thought about the surgeries didn't matter. So obviously the way that the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network is kind of framing and describing this court case is very much to kind of explain it to lots of individuals who may not be familiar. But basically, a court case came out against the DC Developmental Disabilities Administration. Three women saying that they had been forced to have procedures against their consent, one being an eye surgery and two being forced abortions. And Brett Kavanaugh, who's now a Supreme Court justice, said, that's fine. So, yeah. So, this, I felt, was a really good court case just to again put that connective tissue just right out there. Bodily autonomy refers to, yes, reproductive health, and that's very important. And again, we've talked a little bit about that in previous episodes. But here we're also seeing how this impacts broader health issues as well. This woman who had eye surgery without her consent. We've talked about this as well in previous episodes, how bodily autonomy is very important. Examples of where bodily autonomy has been not taken into consideration and why it is very important. There have been statutes both on state levels as well as, I think declarations from the UN. For a more international perspective, all about bodily autonomy and why self-advocacy and all of that are very important. But this happened in 2007, and so many people like to think that these forced sterilizations, forced abortions, and that those types of things happened well in the past, and that's just not true. Another website that I am going to reference quite a bit is supportedecisionmaking.org. So supportedecisionmaking.org is a website that not only provides the resources and tools for individuals with disabilities, but also I think broader kind of care teams. So family caregivers, parents, guardians, and friends, family, people who are involved in their care and can be involved in decision making, really does provide a plethora of resources and information around supported decision making. Supported decision making just simply means that the care team is making decisions with the individual's wishes and health goals, choice really being, I think, at the forefront, thinking about what will be best for that individual while framing it in their own wishes. I've talked a little bit about shared decision making. It's the same idea. It's, I've been diagnosed with X, and my spouse is going to be part of the group that's helping take care of me. So when we're talking about what my kind of trajectory, my care plan looks like, bringing them into that decision-making process, what does that look like? How can I make sure that they are being an advocate for what I want? How can I make sure that what my wishes and wants are being communicated to the healthcare professionals across the board? All of these things, the supported decision making .org website provides a lot of great information there. In addition, they also do outline some legislation and laws broken down by state to talk about guardianship laws, supported decision making statutes, etc., so that you can have just a full breadth of understanding. So, to me, after watching both Immaculate and The First Omen, these were some of the ideas that were just really sitting with me. It's like, what do these films have to say about beyond the reproductive health component, but just bodily autonomy for folks in need of additional health care? Because pregnancy is kind of that, which is why we always say, you know, abortion is health care. You know, oftentimes an individual that needs to terminate a pregnancy is doing so because that pregnancy puts their health at significant risk. And so abortion becomes health care. And so, you know, again, threading this needle, what do these films have to say about bodily autonomy? Obviously, we've talked about it through the lens of abortion and reproductive health. Going a step beyond that, the thing that really struck with me, obviously, in Immaculate, you have Cecilia, who is sick. She's experiencing some real difficulties with this pregnancy. She's sick. And she has to lie and come up with a scheme just so that she can get out to a hospital and get additional help. I don't know why that was just something that, you know, when you hear women discuss, you know, particularly challenging pregnancies or birth, it's very easy to gloss over the impact that this can have on the body. I did an episode with Jen Adams where we talked about the movie Inside. We really went in on some of those experiences. And Jen just wrote a piece about Immaculate and The First Omen, really cruxing it in some of these finer points. And so I'm going to reference that in the show notes as well. But, you know, again, this is taking it outside of, you know, just, okay, pregnancy, someone wanting to terminate a pregnancy, but maybe everything is going fine, too. Now we have a medical situation, and we're still denying someone healthcare or struggling with that. They're taking her to the hospital, but it had to get to a certain point for that to be the case. Really prioritizing the health of the fetus over her health and well-being. So, I don't know. That was just something that really stuck with me. I think also we have to look at the settings of these films. We have in Immaculate the hospice care component where you have a lot of older and elderly women that are part of the convent or had been part of the convent that are receiving care, this kind of end-of-life care. And again, I've talked a little bit about the intersections of ageism and ableism. And we see a bit of that here as well. The nuns that are in charge of providing this care are obviously doing it with tons of compassion. But we also see just how kind of dismissed some of these women are. Now, there's kind of bigger reasons as to why this may be as we learn more about these are women that have been part of these plots. It's all very convoluted within that component, but it's just really interesting to me to see, you know, while Cecilia, a young woman who is struggling for autonomy, within her own health is, treating older women or caring for older women that are experiencing kind of the same thing on a different kind of track. You have in particular the older nun that is coming into Cecilia's room snipping her hair, and we find out that she has these brands on her feet, and obviously a sign of mistreatment. It's just really interesting to me that it's really expanding that scope of bodily autonomy, especially in terms of women. Women have a much harder time having their health concerns and issues taken seriously within the health field. Talking to doctors, it's very easy to get certain things dismissed. This is especially true as a woman with a disability. It becomes very focused on, well, we're only treating things that are, kind of emergent care related, or, well, your disability is this, and this is what we're concerned about, but not thinking about more broader holistic components of health. And so I just wanted to throw that out there as well. We flip over to the First Omen, and again, we have this orphanage setting, and we have Carlita, who is just not being, I think, treated very well. And I think this speaks to, especially within certain times, but even recently, some of the mistreatment that can come from being in foster care or being in these types of settings and not having access of healthcare and proper interventions, be this related to physical health or even mental and behavioral health. So, yeah, I wanted to throw that out there too, because I thought that that was a really interesting thing. At the end of the First Omen, we have Carlita, we have Margaret, and we have the female child. All women survive. They're able to walk out of this fire, or escape the fire, rather, at the end of the First Omen. They're setting up shop at kind of like this mountain cabin. Father Brennan comes to them and gives them a warning that the church will find them, that if he's able to find them, the church is going to find them and they're going to be in danger. Margaret's not hearing it, tells him off, and he goes away. But we have these three women. We have this young child, the now slightly older, the female infant, now I think looks to be maybe five or so. We have Carlita, who's slightly older, but seems at a much different place in her health. She seems very happy, healthy, and striving and thriving. A complete juxtaposition to what we saw while she was at the orphanage. And a lot of that comes from the treatment and interventions that she was getting. She was in a much better environment for her. And so she was striving and thriving. So I found that interesting, and kind of a probably unintended little bit there that I took away from. No, these films just really stuck with me in how they talked about bodily autonomy. And I felt really compelled to record an episode because, like I said, the beginning, I think that it's really easy to cut off the conversations around bodily autonomy, to not include individuals with disabilities and more of the broader elements of bodily autonomy in these conversations. Yes, it is absolutely important to keep so much of the conversation framed around reproductive health, especially now. Because reproductive health is still health. Reproductive health care is still health care, and it's vital and it's important, and it does impact everyone and individuals with disabilities. But to not take a moment and think about the broader repercussions of what these things can mean, what taking away certain rights can lead to, I think is something that's really important. I wanted to kind of close things out by talking a little bit about the religious components. And I've mentioned this, I want to say in the episode around Carrie, but I wanted to dig a little bit deeper into kind of how religion in general views and treats individuals with disabilities. There's really no, kind of fast and easy way to describe it because it's going to be so incredibly varied from church to church, sect to sect, all of those things. But another Leaving Eden episode that I will link in the show notes is kind of an in-depth conversation with someone who has been diagnosed with autism and talks a lot about their experience growing up in a very, I think, conservative, fundamental church, and how it becomes a real hardship in how you are navigating your disability and how the church and folks that are there within the church are viewing your disability. When we go to the Bible and say, well, what does the Bible have to say about disability? What does the Bible really have to say about anything? This becomes kind of a useless question and a useless track to go down because it's never really about what the Bible says. It's about the interpretation of what someone thinks that this quote is saying. There is a Bible quote, or rather a Bible verse, that I want to dig into here. And this is John chapter 9, verses 1 through 3. And this is from the New King James Version. So it goes a little something like this. Now, as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. So that's a little bit of the breakdown of this specific verse. And I think this is why it becomes difficult to really hone in on what a church or a specific sect think about disability, because there's a number of different ways to look at this. Other verses or other bits of the Bible may speak more to, disability being something that is related to sin, a trespass that a parent has done and now the affliction has been passed on to their children, or a trespass that they had provided, now they have this hardship or this whatever. But clearly here in this story, Jesus is like, well, this person isn't blind because he or his parents have sinned, but he's going to be an example of God's work. This is what I want to talk about for a minute. And this relates not only to some thoughts and feelings that I have related to just disability and religion, but really I think was something that I thought about for watching Immaculate and the First Omen. So it's about righteousness still. It's this idea of healing through faith, of, you know, God's work, him being able to see, will be a testament of God, but he has to be righteous enough to receive that blessing, right? Or he has to be kind of that example. And in the Leaving Eden podcast, with the guest Elena talking about her experience being neurodivergent within kind of this evangelical fundamentalist sect in church, she talks a little bit about the challenge of never being good enough for that relationship, that closeness to God, that sense of salvation, of being pure enough. And even though it's this whole idea of not saying the quiet bit out loud, she goes further on to talk about how, as someone who is not neurodivergent, she, you know, one of the way that that presents is, you know, kind of a fixation or an obsession over something, whether that be a hobby or what have you. And she talked about how, you know, in some aspects, the church will embrace this. Like if you have an obsession over learning scripture and, you know, it translates into a dedication to the church in some way or a service to the church, that's good, right? That's a good thing. But if your obsession is Pokemon, or she talked about like bringing a stuffed animal to church, or how some of these different ways that this can manifest, you know, they're not good within the church and they can be punished. And so it just becomes this dissonance of, you know, very complicated. And so thinking about how this relates to the First Omen and Immaculate, we see this in a number of different ways. You know, both women are selected essentially because they've been deemed the appropriate vessel. Now, for Margaret, it's very specific in terms of kind of, I think, twofold. One is that she has been raised within the church, but also she serves the function of being a product of the beast. They refer to the father of the Antichrist as the beast. So I'm going to refer to the father of the Antichrist as the beast. So she needs to be his progeny, his daughter, to birth the next, to birth the Antichrist. And so she's selected on that merit, and she survived. And so she's kind of elevated in that way. And so she serves her purpose and then is dismissed. The female baby is the spare, right? And they don't care that this child is going to be burned alive. They just wanted the son. And so I think you get into, I served a purpose. Like my uniqueness served the purpose, and now is being cast. Now I'm being cast out. I'm no longer of use. In Immaculate, you get Cecilia, who is deemed of being special because she survived her near-death experience. And this is one of the reasons that she's summoned to this convent and to be, you know, the future mother of Christ spawn. And so, again, once she's kind of served that purpose, she becomes less, you know, her value changes. Also, again, going back to the fact that she was experiencing health issues, didn't really seem all that important. That was the annoying bit. When she's being able to be exalted and viewed as this Mary figure and following protocol, then that's nice. But when she's being difficult, and being pregnant and being in pain, and that becomes a problem. And so Elena, within the Leaving Eden podcast, talks a lot about her experience of being someone who's neurodivergent, needing to stem in church and that being a problem. But again, if you had a hyperfixation on learning scriptures, that's not the problem. It's very interesting, and I think a lot of us who have some experiences within those sects and that relationship to religion as well, or similar experiences, can speak to that. You know, it's get into the aspects of faith healing. And, you know, what does it mean? The fact that even though my dad, you know, did lots of laying on of hands, and I went to lots of different, you know, church services where, you know, lots of people praying over me for healing, and it never happened. Does that mean that God views me as less than? Like, what am I supposed to take away from that based on what some of the other scriptures that we're learning say? You know, individuals that are healed from their afflictions being kind of a testament to God's mercy and goodness. And yet I'm being prayed over and nothing's happening. Does that mean I'm bad? You know, and again, unlike, you know, what the Bible verse that I provided said, you know, my dad did very much take the stance of, you know, I think you're kind of a product of sin. You're not a righteous and good being. Like, if your heart was on fire for God enough, if you were pure enough, you would be healed. But, you know, you're your mother's child, and so you're awful. I think that goes a little outside of the necessary, like, actual church teachings, but I think you get what I'm saying there. And so, you know, the dismissal of, I don't know, I also had thoughts and feelings about just the scientific experimentation that both films kind of really lightly graze over, real hardcore themes and imagery and ideas related to eugenics, and, you know, especially some of that medical testing that I talked about eugenics a few episodes ago, and kind of gave me the ick there. And then we get to the ending of Immaculate. So she gives birth to this baby. We never see the baby. It's very Rosemary's Baby in that regard, right? And all we hear are these different sounds that are coming from this infant. Sounds that we wouldn't associate with, you know, the normal sounds of an infant just being born. And she kills it. Obviously, lots of feelings here. I guess I just don't know necessarily where I fall, because I get the fuck you element of it for sure. But it just, you don't know. It just seems a little interesting to, you know, have that play with a newborn that's struggling to breathe, I guess. It's weird because we don't get any visual of the newborn. It's, I don't know. It's just, it just kind of left me feeling like, huh, all right. But again, I get the fuck you of it. And I think that that's obviously the important piece, but I don't know. There was just something about, like, we get the sounds of the baby and difficulty breathing, and then smash. I don't know. I'm probably taking this way too far and thinking about it in ways that are not, I think, in keeping with what the message of the film is, but it was just something that also stuck with me. So, yeah, that is a conversation about these two films. This was, like I said, we went on a journey, we unpacked some things, it was a little bit messy, but again, I like the opportunity of when I see films to, especially in the theater, to be able to come and have conversations with them as people are talking about them. So, I would be really interested to hear other people's kinds of takes. I referenced some things I'm going to be putting in the show notes, so if I hit on topic and you want to explore more, there's going to be some resources for you to delve into. But I would love to hear what other people thought about, you know, some of these broader ideas of bodily autonomy discussed in these films. I think it's a really important conversation to have. So thank you for listening and for giving, I think, the space to have a different kind of conversation than what we've really had here before. I'm talking about something that's really new out there in theaters and really honing in on how it relates to some things that maybe we've touched on briefly in other episodes, but going, I think, to a different level. It's always really hard to figure out how deep we go, how far we go in different directions with different topics. It's all, to me, interconnected. To have conversations about reproductive health and bodily autonomy means having conversations about all sorts of things, gender-affirming care and the importance around that, in addition to just bodily autonomy in general, for youth, for individuals with disabilities. It just becomes really complicated and all enmeshed. So I hope I've done a good job at kind of breaking some things out, explaining some of my thoughts and feelings in ways that maybe resonate with you. I would love to hear if you have, you know, some takeaways from these films that, you know, kind of relate to some of the things maybe we touched on. Feel free to reach out to me. You can send me an email at bodiesofwhore@gmail.com. I am on Twitter, X, at bodieswhore, on Instagram at bodiesofwhorepodcast, and on Blue Sky at bodiesofwhore. So all of that will be in the show notes. And, you know, do reach out to me. Say hey. I love hearing from folks who have listened to an episode and want to kind of share their perspective as well. A huge thank you also to Anatomy of a Scream, as always, for being the heart and the home to Bodies of Horror. Please take a moment, if you haven't already done so, to show some love to not just Bodies of Horror, but to the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad by, you know, first off, making sure you're subscribed to the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad feed wherever you're accessing, getting your podcast, but also leaving reviews and ratings, I think, is also so beneficial and so important to help other folks discover not only just Bodies of Horror, but the other shows here on the feed. So please take a few moments and give those ratings and reviews, because they really do a huge, huge service, and we're really grateful for that. So I think that's all for this episode, and really excited for what is on deck. I do have some guests lined up for future episodes, so if you've been, you know, like, I really like episodes where you have guests and there's more of a conversation, rest assured, that is on the docket. So I appreciate your patience there, and until next time.
The Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad.